Welcome to another episode of COVID Chronicles, a podcast by, for, and about people affiliated with Portland Mennonite Church in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum, and my guest is Bill Conwell. Bill, it's so great to have you with me.
Thanks, Gloria.
As you know, we start at the beginning, and I know a little bit about you, and I'm pretty sure you were not born in Oregon. Can you tell us where you were born?
Kristen prompted me how I'm to answer this question. I was not born in Venezuela, despite my parents' attempts for 7 years to have a child. And every time they went stateside, they visited fertility clinics and to no avail. And then they moved to Trinidad in the British West Indies, and they continued unsuccessfully. And they had a housekeeper who told them the Caribbean folk wisdom that if you make a stew made of these tiny little clams that are everywhere on the beaches of the Caribbean, they call them chip chips, that you'll get pregnant immediately. And so having failed at everything else, they tried that, and I was born in Trinidad.
What were your parents doing trekking around the world?
My dad left high school to go to sea and ended up a captain in a steamship company. And they stationed him as the port captain in Port of Spain, Trinidad. And my mother worked at a virology lab run by the Rockefeller Foundation in Trinidad.
So that's where they actually met?
No, they actually met when my father's ship was docked in New Orleans, and he sort of had a girl in every port, and he called on the girl in New Orleans, and she'd moved out, and my mother had moved into the apartment. So they met by that happenstance.
That is a great story. So I'm guessing from what you've already told me that you are the oldest. Do you have siblings?
I am. I have a brother who's 3 years younger.
Do you know if they tried the same thing to get pregnant with him?
I don't know, but they did not seem to have as much trouble with him. And so perhaps they did. He was born in Mobile, Alabama, and those beaches too have these chip clams.
So where did you actually grow up?
From Trinidad, we moved to Alabama, spent 2 years there. We moved to northern New Jersey, a bedroom community of New York, lived there for 2 years, moved down to Rockville, Maryland, lived there for 2 years, moved back to New Jersey when I was in fourth grade, and I attended fourth grade through high school in New Jersey. So I think that's properly where you could say I grew up.
Do you remember making some of those moves? You were relatively young, but do you remember that?
Not the early ones. Of course, my memory is clouded or obscured by being familiar with family photo albums that show events. So I have a hard time distinguishing what I remember and what I'm prompted to remember from the photos. But I certainly remember our first time in New Jersey when I was in first grade.
Where were your parents' actual home areas, if there was such a thing? Where were they raised?
My mother was born and raised in Mobile, Alabama, and my father's family is from rural Delaware, but they moved just before he was born down to Norfolk, Virginia. So he was born there, but he claims Delaware as the family home.
Because I was thinking you had some sort of southern roots of some kind. That's on mostly your mother's side.
That's right.
So when you finally landed in New Jersey and spent the rest of your growing up time there, what did your family do for fun? Now, if your parents were used to kind of traveling around, did they also trek around with their children, like on vacations and things? Or what happened, say, during the summer when you were growing up?
Well, I was active in Boy Scouts, and so there was always a Boy Scout camp that was a component of the summer. But we didn't travel very far afield. I never had been west of the Mississippi until I was in grad school. We would go down to Delaware to visit family and cemeteries in Delaware, or we'd do the same into Virginia. And occasionally we'd go down to the Outer Banks of North Carolina. But that was generally about as far afield as we went.
Visiting cemeteries?
Yeah, my parents are into genealogy. So most of the kinfolk, of course, are under the ground. So you got to make a stop there.
I really like cemeteries, so that's really intriguing to me. Were you in the Boy Scouts for quite a long period of time, say right up through high school, or did that end at some point?
No, that continued through high school, and after I sort of topped out in Boy Scouts, I transferred to the program for older teens, which is called Explorers, and there was an Explorer post in town that I continued with. It was a little unusual in that I grew up in the town in New Jersey where Bell Labs has its headquarters, and the Explorer post was headquartered up at Bell Labs, and so the adult sponsors were largely Bell Labs employees, and so we did a lot of geeky things in Bell Labs after hours as part of the Explorer activities.
Please give me an example of what one of those geeky things might have been.
One was some of the people who wrote the Unix language were among the advisors. And so we got to play on the mainframes through the teletype terminals that they used. We also, I remember, measured the speed of light by bouncing lasers off mirrors with timing gear down the long corridors of some of the buildings.
And I know that you are now into shortwave radio, is that right?
Ham radio, yep. And I've been into that since age 12. I took a hiatus for kids and career, but now that we have an empty nest, I'm able to get back to that.
And where did that interest start? Do you know?
I was always sort of a nerdy kid, and there was an era when nerdy kids, some of them sort of found their way into radio. Now, of course, they get into computers, but that wasn't an option in my era. And my dad did time in the Navy where he learned the Morse code. And being at sea, he was accustomed to listening to shortwave broadcasts. And so when I was 10 or so, we went to a Boy Scout auction of radio gear. And we came home with some shortwave radios, and he remembered enough of Morse code from his Navy days to copy some local ham radio operators, and we connected with them, and I ended up getting my license.
What is it about ham radio for you?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. The part that I enjoy most is the Morse code operating. Morse code's been around for 160 years. And it's kind of fun to be proficient in this old, the original form of digital communications. And it's simple enough that you can get by with a weak signal to very remote points. And so you can talk to people around the world pretty readily with Morse code, whereas with voice, that would be more of a challenge.
We could spend hours just going into that for sure, but we're going to move on. It may come up again later. What else were you interested in, say, your high school years? Not necessarily the academic part, but extracurricular activities? Were you into sports, music, any of those kinds of things?
My heart was in radio. My parents steered me into piano and French horn and tennis and golf and football and baseball, and none of those things really took the way that radio did. So I did a lap on each of those, but I can't say any of them really was an interest of mine.
Academically, were you a good student? And what was starting to be of interest to you, or maybe had been for a while, again, in those high school years?
I think the ham radio introduction at, I think I was 12 when I got my first license, sort of set me in a direction towards technology. And so I paid attention in math and science classes. And then that made the choice of college. It helped guide that selection. And so dominoes kept falling in that technology direction.
During your growing up years, was there any church life in your family?
There was. I don't know how far back to go. My mother was originally Baptist, and they would have revival meetings in town where people would preach fire and brimstone. And she was up in the front row of one of these meetings when she was a young teen. And the preacher seemed to single her out and threaten her with hellfire and damnation unless she came up and professed Christ as her savior. And he just caught her on a bad day, and she gave him some lip and walked out. And thereafter, she went to the Episcopalian church in Mobile. And my father was raised Methodist, but he was a choir boy in the Presbyterian church. And because of that sort of diverse background, every time we moved, we did some church shopping. But when we ended up in New Jersey for the long spell, we ended up going to an Episcopal church.
And you would attend on a pretty regular basis?
Yep. Yeah, my parents were very involved, and so naturally the kids were involved too.
So after high school, was it understood or assumed that you would go to college? There was sort of no question about that?
There was no question about that. My mother has a lot of schooling. My father has a high school degree. He later took some college classes, but he wanted to make sure that I got to college. His only hesitation was that I graduated high school young. I was just 17 because of the sequence of schools that I bounced between. And he thought I was a little young for college, and he suggested I take a year off and become a radio operator on a merchant marine ship for a year and do some maturing. And I disregarded that advice and predictably was at times immature my first years in college.
Did you ever wish at some point, maybe down the road, that you had taken that year and done that?
I recognize there was a lost opportunity there and experiences that I would certainly treasure now had I done that. But at every fork in the road, we make decisions and we pass up some opportunities and experiences and gain others. So I'm sure the path I took was rich in a distinct way that I might not otherwise have experienced.
So where did you go to college and how did you make that decision?
Well, I wanted to go to school in the South because of this sort of family tendency. We felt a little bit strangers in a strange land in the New York suburbs. And so I applied to Georgia Tech and Rice, and Georgia Tech was where I ended up.
At what point did you have to declare a major? And by then, what were you thinking?
I knew from the get-go that I was going to be in electrical engineering, so I started taking courses in that direction from the very beginning. And then I also elected a program that they had that some other colleges have where you can alternate quarters at school with quarters in industry so that you gain some work experience along the way. So I ended up working a year and a half in engineering intern capacities for different firms. So I ended up taking 5 years to get out of school.
And were those businesses right there fairly locally, or did you have to go somewhere else?
RCA was at one time a bona fide company. Now it's just a throwaway brand on cheap Chinese merchandise. But RCA had a business making broadcast transmitting antennas. And so I worked for 3 terms doing broadcast transmitting antennas. One of the projects I worked on was the antenna array that was up on the North Tower of the World Trade Center that was the broadcast center for all the New York media. And then I switched. RCA also had a defense business. It was their missile and surface radar division, not something you hear a lot about in the Mennonite church. And I worked on programming a assembler code for the SPY-1 phased array radar that tracked incoming targets and helped steer the guns to shoot down missiles before they rained on the ship. And then I did my last term working for Radio Free Europe in Spain and Portugal.
How did you get that position?
I just saw a posting on a bulletin board at Georgia Tech inviting applicants, and they took interns every summer to try to interest U.S. engineering students in working for Radio Free Europe, and so caught my eye, and it was a good summer.
So you were just there for a summer?
Right.
And is it safe to say that your work or your interest in that was the technical end of things as opposed to being on the air?
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm strongly introverted. I would not go in a public-facing on-air capacity, but I was glad wiring harnesses for audio consoles or troubleshooting antennas out in the pastures.
And while you were there, did you get to travel a bit in Spain or in Europe?
I did a little bit. They took me to Munich, which was the headquarters, and I glad-handed a couple of the suits there. And then I had a high school classmate who had ended up in London, and we backpacked along Hadrian's Wall from west to east for a couple of weeks at the end of the summer.
I sense a theme here. It's all about broadcasting and radio and electricity.
right?
What did you plan to do with this degree when you were finished?
Well, I came to understand through my time primarily at RCA that certainly in big engineering organizations, the longer you spend, the more specialized you get technically, unless you go into management, but then you have to deal with people, and that's another unappealing sort of prospect. And I saw a lot of people at RCA, which had these long span programs that would go over decades, they would get in a technology like there was a early warning radar system up in Alaska, Northern Canada, and Greenland that listened for radar pings for missiles coming from Russia. And it was first conceived back in the 50s, and RCA made a bunch of money engineering it and installing it. And then in the 60s, it was in operation. And then in the 70s, it was still in operation. They had to maintain it. And I saw these people who had gotten out of school and gotten into this really interesting, at the time, technology, but had gotten slotted into it, and they knew everything about it. They couldn't be replaced, and they spent their whole career in this narrow field when the rest of the world kind of passed them by. And I found that sort of discouraging. So I was interested in using my engineering in a way that I wouldn't be slotted with a way that I'd feel stuck. So then I decided to go to law school. So right after I graduated Georgia Tech, I went on to law school.
Where did that come from?
Again, it was the Bell Labs influence, because all my high school classmates had typically dads who worked up at the labs, and some of them were patent attorneys. So I understood at an early age that being a patent attorney was a thing, and it required technical expertise, but it allowed you to sort of stay on the leading edge instead of getting snagged in some technology that might become dated.
So did you do that right after you graduated from college, or was there some time in between?
I did it right after.
And where did you go to law school?
I went also in Atlanta to Emory.
And how long was that program going to be?
That was going to be 3 years.
Did you ever get tired of studying?
Yes. Yeah, I was glad when it was over.
You decided to become a patent attorney, and that's what you've been doing ever since?
Indeed. Yep.
Well, you're still in Georgia, so tell me where this new career took you, or if you had any plans to go somewhere else besides the South.
I finished my first year at Emory, and then at the start of the second year, I was living in a dormitory that the university had bought. It was an old motel, and all the rooms faced onto a common patio walkway, and I was looking out my front window, and I saw a woman move in next door. I introduced myself to her, and that turned out to be Kristen. And I saw in the moving that one of the books on her bookcase was a Bible. And so I thought inviting her to church would be a good first date. So I invited her to church. And one thing led to another. We became engaged. And that prompted my first trip west of the Mississippi. I visited her folks in Yellowstone. Her dad was a seasonal ranger there for 30 or 40 years. And I liked a lot about the West. And so then when it came time to look around for job opportunities, I looked in Atlanta and D.C., but I also looked in Seattle and Portland and Richland, Washington, because Kristen had been raised in Central Washington. And so I wanted to at least have the appearance of being interested in living near my in-laws. And as it turned out, that was a good choice.
So where did you actually move to?
I moved to Aloha, Oregon, and started working for a patent firm downtown Portland.
What was Kristen doing in Atlanta?
She was going to nursing school. She had gotten a four-year bachelor's degree in California, then wanted to get a nursing degree. And at the time, most nursing programs for people who already had a bachelor's degree were 3 years long. But Emory had one that included the intervening summer, and she could get a bachelor's of science in nursing in just 2 years. And so she drove her Pinto across country, thinking, I can spend 2 years in the South without getting engaged to some Southern guy who's going to want me to stay in the South. She'd just keep her blinders on. And then we met the first day, and it turned out that she lured me west.
So it sounds like the timing in terms of your schooling was just about perfect, that you had two more years and she was there for two. Is that right? Did I get that
right? Exactly. Yeah, we graduated the same day.
So you came to Aloha, Oregon, and started a family at some point.
Yes, we had a rental house out in Aloha, and then we bought a house in Southwest Portland. And our daughter, Hannah, was born in 1986. And then 2 years later, our son, David, was born in 88. And there still are two. Hannah is living in Canby and working in Portland. And our son, David, is presently in Houston, where he's been working for an oil company, but he's tired of the fossil fuel industry. So he's going to go to California to get some more schooling to get out of the oil business.
And he just got married not too long ago.
He got married in October, yes, to a childhood sweetheart who he met in the neighborhood and in middle school. And the plans for a traditional wedding were canceled because of COVID. And so they had a couple nearby friends in their age bracket attend their wedding. But Kristen and I and the bride's parents participated by Zoom. The four of us got together on our deck and just watched a common laptop while they got wed down on the Gulf Coast.
This connection to Yellowstone, I think that it filtered into your family as well. It was such a part of Kristen's growing up. Is that true? Tell me about life in Yellowstone.
Sure. Kristen's father took that job in 1960. Kristen was born in 1960, so her first trip to Yellowstone was before her first birthday, and she's been there every summer since. So it's now in the 60s. And I was introduced to it in 83, and then we got married there in 84. And then we've been back together essentially every year since then. And we're just back 2 weeks ago from our 2021 trip to Yellowstone.
Tell me what you do now when you're there. How long do you spend there? Do you have specific places that you recommend?
Well, what we do is different than what most people do because there's so many bucket list sort of things you have to see. You have to see the Grand Canyon, the Yellowstone, this and that. But since we've already sort of gotten those under our belt, we like just hanging out in some of the big valleys, the Hayden Valley and the Lamar Valley in the eastern part of the park and towards the northeast entrance, and just watch the wildlife. And it's kind of low key, but it suits us.
Do you stay in the lodges?
The lodges are hard to get into. We actually spent two nights at Old Faithful this year, but many seasons we don't actually stay in the park. We stay either in Gardner up on the north entrance or in the towns of Silvergate or Cook City at the northeast entrance. And rarely we'd stay at the west entrance town of West Yellowstone and just drive into the park every day. This year, I was able to get the senior citizen pass where you pay once, and now I have lifetime admission to all national parks. So that was pretty great.
Well, somehow the two of you also ended up at Portland Mennonite Church. Can you tell me that story?
Sure. Kristen's parents were both raised in Church of the Brethren and did voluntary service. Chester went to China and Rosemary went to Nigeria. And so they were pretty big brethren. Kristen was raised in a town that didn't have a brethren church, but her heart was always in the brethren faith. So when we moved to Portland, we looked up Peace Church of the Brethren and the pastor, Rick Ukina, and he helped us plan the wedding ceremony. And once we moved into town, we attended there. That was kind of fun because Tom Lauderdale, the fellow of Pink Martini, was a young teen then, and he played piano for the church. His dad, Kirby Lauderdale, was a parishioner. But ultimately, that church didn't have a very vibrant set of young kids. I mean, many of the congregation were older, and we were looking forward to having a family. And so we were kind of looking around at other options. And after visiting some other churches, Kristen said, well, you know, Mennonites are first cousins. Why don't we try Portland Mennonite? And it just immediately felt like a good fit. And so we've been at PMC since about 1989.
So you've just survived a year of COVID, just like the rest of us. What was your work situation like during that time? Now, you work with a firm that's based outside of your house, I assume? But tell me kind of what you were able to do during this past year, just work-wise.
I actually left the law firm downtown in 1999, and I joined a little tech company out in Beaverton then. And so I'm still doing patent law, but now I'm just working for this one company. And like everyone else, they shut down the office and had us work at home. So I've got a card table set up in our downstairs, and I've got my monitor and keyboard. And every morning, pretty much, I report to work and do what I do in the office, except I do it on the card table downstairs. I actually don't report every morning. I actually work 3/4 time. I cut back a couple years ago, but yeah, I still enjoy it. And despite the loosening of some COVID restrictions, I'm still doing that and don't have any immediate plans to return to the office.
Is there still some place in the world that you haven't been to that you'd really like to get to in the next couple of years?
Oh, yeah. Most of the world we haven't been to. So never been to Asia. So that's pretty high on the list. And I think we'd like to spend some time exploring New Zealand. Yeah, it certainly seems very appealing from a distance.
And just finishing up, tell me a little bit about what you're actually doing with ham radio now. What are your involvements in that field?
The activities that I participate in mostly are weekend-long contests where people try to work as many people in as many countries as possible. And so there's a contest coming up second week in July, and a buddy of mine is coming over on Saturday, and we're going to do some prep for that. And we're going to do it as a team and try to put in a good score, work in 1,000 or more people in 100 or more countries, and most of it are on Morse code.
How do you do a contest with ham radio? What are you trying to do?
Trying to contact as many people as possible and copy their information correctly, because ultimately all of the logs of the contest go to the contest sponsors who cross-check everything. You know, if you say your name is Bill and you're in Oregon, did the guy in Bulgaria copy that correctly? And did you copy his information correctly? It's a speed and accuracy test, and also a test of your radio and antennas. And yeah, it's a proficiency contest.
And do you have to do this within a certain length of time?
Yeah, typically the contests run 24 or 48 hours. The one upcoming is 24 hours from 5 a.m. Saturday, I think, to 5 a.m. Sunday.
It's like a marathon.
Yep. Yeah, well, there's a lot of sleep recovery to be done afterwards.
And where is maybe the farthest or the most interesting place? I know this isn't a fair question, but that never stops me, that you've been in touch with during your ham radio career.
I've worked all the countries that you can pretty much work. I've got 300 countries in my logbook. I think the one that catches a lot of interest is Antarctica, because there are often expeditions down there that include ham radio. And there have also been ham radio stations up in the International Space Station. I've talked to them.
Well, Bill, what an awesome, amazing, interesting life. Thank you so much for taking the time to share with us.
Well, thank you so much for undertaking this massive project. I'm just amazed at the catalog of interviews you've done. And I know the interviews are relatively short, but you spend hours behind the scenes cleaning them up. So thank you for your labor of love here.
You are most welcome. And thank you for joining us for this episode of COVID Chronicles. If something you heard raised questions or you discovered a connection, take the opportunity to reach out and continue the conversation. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum. Until next time, stay well and keep the faith.